Main menu.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Main Menu, ACB Radio's look at technology from a blindness perspective. This week on Main Menu, we hear from Larry Skukan and Rob Meredith from American Printing House for the Blind, all about the new Studio Recorder version 3.0. And then we hear about the Voice It All, brought to us by Rick Harmon. That's all coming up this week on ACB Radio's Main Menu.
In the studios with me today is Rob Meredith, author of Studio Recorder, with some exciting overview of Studio Recorder version 3.0 features. Hey, Rob.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, we're pretty excited about this, and I hear you're going to go through.
Yeah, we're going to run through the what's new and elaborate a little bit. We're not going to have time to get into much detail. This won't teach you how to use the feature, but it'll maybe get you interested enough to dig out the manual and experiment for yourself a little bit. Let's run through the What's New file. This is SR 3.0. We have at the top of the list the mix command. And there's, as we discussed over on Blind Cool Tech in the Mix show back from 2005, I don't remember, it was like probably early December. You could go there if you want more info, but we discussed basically there's three kinds of mixes you can do with SR. There's the traditional put the thing you want to mix on the clipboard and go to the place in the file where you want the mix to start and press the mix command, which happens to be X. And it has the ability to set levels there. There's also a sound-on-sound type mix where you can arm a document for synchronized playback and hit record and record on top of that document as much as you want. Finally, there's a similar to the second one, similar to the sound-on-sound, is what we call a synchronized mix, which is basically you arm for synchronized play, create a new document, tap record, and then at that point you're playing one document and recording into another, but it's in a synchronized manner. And then later, when you're ready, you mix the tracks together in the traditional way with the mix command. It's a little confusing, but I think if you go through the mix show, and if you keep in mind that the arm for synchronized playback command in that show, it actually has a different name. I think we were calling it arm for recording or something like that, but we changed things a little bit, but it's a lot clearer now, and it makes more sense the way we decided to do it. Let's see. I'll briefly go through ARM for synchronized play. We just touched on that with the mix command, but that's the second feature. Essentially, what that does is when you use that command, it makes Studio Recorder note the current document.
So you issue this command in a document that you want to play?
Right. And it notes that document for playing, and then when you switch to any other document, including the armed document, either way, when you tap record, the document you armed starts playing at the position where it currently is. So you can actually arm and then navigate in the document you're going to play to find exactly where you want to start it. The sequence doesn't so much matter. The important thing is when you actually tap record is when the actual arming, when the benefits of the arming are realized. To cancel an arm, you can do shift escape. Let's see.
You arm more than one document at a time?
No, you can only arm one because we can only play one document at a time. But essentially, if you just keep doing a mix, you can do a mix and then arm that mixed document, and
right.
Then yeah, just keep building it up that way.
Okay. Anyway.
All right. We're not going to go in order. We're going to talk about the click track now because it's related to mixing. We have a new feature called click track, and a click track is basically a modern day term for a metronome. And this command lets you generate a document that contains a click track. And the reason one might want to do that is to keep your rhythm while you're doing a mix. It's kind of a strange feature to have in Studio Recorder, but it turns out it was relatively easy to write, and somebody did request it, and it seemed like a pretty good idea. I haven't actually used it myself yet in a practical way. I thought I might, but unfortunately I did all my playing with the mix feature before the click track stuff was available. But the idea is that you generate a click track and then use the arm that click track for synchronized play, and then switch to a new document and begin recording, and then you can hear the rhythm of the click track in your headphones, hopefully, and that'll keep things going well if you want to sing or play your guitar or whatever. That's a way to do it. Another way to do it would be to mix the click track into your project as you go. In other words, take the click track as your first track, and then either do a sound-on-sound or synchronized mix into that click track. And as long as things don't clip, at the end of the project, you can negate the original click track and take it out of the project.
That is so cool.
Yeah, so you can carry it with you the whole time until you don't need it any longer, and then throw it away at the end. And it lets you do, it has options like beats per measure and such, number of measures.
So it actually creates a sound for you like a metronome.
Right. And another cool feature we added in the click track area is that when you're on the beats per measure edit field, if you're not sure exactly what you want your rhythm to be, you can just tap it out on the shift key.
Can we show that to people?
Yeah. Just all go right, ahead and create a new document.
Got a new document.
Just head over to Tools and pick the click track option.
Generate click track.
Generate click track.
Menu code. Okay. Beats per minute 2550Z.
Beats per minute. I'm just going to tap out on the shift key right here, right?
All right. Yeah.
All right.
Now, go ahead and press enter. And hit play.
Amazing. Very cool. All right.
And you can, of course, change the time signature or whatever you need to do. You can change the level of the click track. You can make it brighter if you're recording like a percussive sound, or you can make it duller if you're just going to sing and you don't really want to have it need it bleeding through so much. You can do all those things, and then, like I said, just throw it away when you're done with it.
And this is actually a file. You can save or do whatever you want. I can hit up arrow and it'll play it again.
Yep, it's a regular. It actually inserts it. I mean, you'd normally want to put a click track into a new document, but it'll just insert it wherever you happen to be in the current document. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the normalize and volume commands and how they've been enhanced to incorporate dynamic compression.
Does everybody know what dynamic compression is already?
Probably not. In case you missed it or don't remember or don't have a passion for dynamic compression. The idea here is that we want to make sounds louder than they could normally be made and avoid clipping. So we're going to raise the volume of a sound to the maximum and then push it beyond the maximum, and in the process smooth out those peaks that would result. This is available both in normalize and in the change volume command. In the case of normalize, when you have dynamic compression enabled, you can use a normalize reference of either RMS or peak level. Peak level is what most people think of when they normalize because you're trying to avoid clipping the peaks. But if you needed to normalize the a whole file, for example, to an RMS reference, you can do that as well. And that lets you get more of a kind of an average, kind of average level. What you can do to understand RMS a little better is take some files that you may have around that you work with on a regular basis that you're familiar with, or just rip some music off of CDs and look at the RMS values that Studio Recorder reports in the measurements dialog. And that'll kind of give you an idea where RMS falls in relation to peak level.
Okay. What about the... How does the peak level one work? Do you just select a desired peak level?
The peak level one works as it usually does, so you need to select a value above 0 dB to actually have the dynamic compression kick in.
So it's going to raise it by that much? Or
no.
Okay, how does that work?
It's going to scale the largest peak in the file relative to the value you specify. So if the largest peak in the file happens to be, say, negative 5 dB, it's going to add 5 dB to the entire file if you pick 0 as a normalized reference. The goal is to scale the largest peak so that it becomes whatever you specify as a normalized reference. So if you specify plus 10, for example, as the normalized reference and use peak level, it's going to essentially make the file 10 dB louder than full scale, but in the process use dynamic compression so that the peaks don't actually clip.
Okay.
And if you're still with us, you'll love this feature. If you're not, try it anyway. It's kind of adds some nice effect and can be used like if you have a recording that has unusual outbursts or peaks in it, like maybe if you're walking down a quiet street and all of a sudden a truck happens to come by. The truck would generally dominate the RMS or the normalized calculation and would cause it, you know, probably a clipping in the recording itself. But you can use this feature to make that truck seem lower relative to everything else and bring everything else up. And we have the same thing over on the volume side. Now, the volume is doing what you discussed earlier, where you're actually just adding. You're adding that much. So if you want to make something 10 dB louder and you don't want it to clip, you essentially say plus 10 and hit that use dynamic compression checkbox, and it'll do its best to make it 10 dB louder. Let's see. We have the crossfade command as a new feature in 3.0, and we talked about this on one of the shows a while back. This is the ability to, essentially, you would use the crossfade when there's a transition in a file, usually. So if you said, hold on a second, I'm going to pause and I'll be right back, and then you walked outside and turned your recorder back on, you might want to smooth the pops in that transition from indoors to outdoors and make it sound more gradual. And that's what the crossfade command will do for you. It'll essentially fade down what you're transitioning from and fade in what you're transitioning to, and then mix those fades together so that you get a blend. And it's real nice for those kind of situations. We have also crossfade delete, which is kind of like the crossfade command, but it's always used in conjunction with a delete command. And what this does is it does a very short crossfade just after delete to minimize any kind of pops in the deletion. The normal delete command just deletes exactly the amount of data that's selected, and that may or may not have, you know, a jagged edge when it's complete. But with the crossfade delete, we do a very short crossfade, 10 milliseconds by default, after the delete. So you actually delete a little bit more material than you specified, but you wind up removing pops and clicks and other problems you can have when you delete part of a file. You especially get those kind of pops and clicks if you have a lot of wind or mic handling noise, usually low frequency noise, in the deletion. Or sometimes if you have a fan running in the background, you can hear a deletion as well. It's just a nice little smoothing technique. We now support the ability to insert files and paste data that varies from the document you're working with in sample size and number of channels. Sample rate has to be the same, but you can, for example, be working on a 16-bit document and insert an 8-bit sound effect, for example, or insert even a 24-bit file. And if your 8-bit sound effect happens to be mono, it automatically converts it to stereo for you. You don't get that message about wave formats are incompatible anymore. So it's a lot more flexible in that way. And the same thing that works with paste. You can, you know, whatever's on the clipboard, as long as the sample rates are the same, you can paste that into any document. Kind of in tandem with this is the ability to change the format of an existing document. You can now use the Select Format command on the File menu and say, I want this document to be 24-bit rather than 16-bit, or I want this to be mono, or perhaps you've accidentally started to record it in mono and you want to switch it to stereo and continue. You can do those kind of things now. Let's talk about background processing a second. We've kind of dove into this whole background processing thing in kind of a light way. We don't have it for any features except MP3 encoding right now, but the idea is that we may have other features that operate in the background in the future. The MP3 coding was real convenient for various reasons, because you can actually start now to encode an MP3 file and continue even to work on the document that's being encoded. You can switch to other documents, create new documents, record even, it doesn't really matter. And you can export any number of documents you want to MP3, and they'll just take care of themselves and queue up and process in the background and let you know when each one's done. And along with that, we have the ability to cancel the background process if you decide to, you know, if you change your mind or if you accidentally encoded the wrong file or it's just taking too long and whatever. And they can.
And that's going to cancel all of them?
That's per window. So if you pick,
okay.
You go to a document that's being exported, you pick cancel background processing from the file menu, and it'll just stop that document.
Okay. Well, what happens if you close a document while it's encoding?
Well, you get a little message telling you that Studio Recorder is working on that document. It tells you the percentage that it's complete in the background processing in the title bar, the dialog. And it gives you the option of either waiting for that to complete or canceling right then and there.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's see. We have dip/rise. And this command is used to vary the volume of a signal over time. Say you have a situation where you recorded a live performance at a club, and you don't want the crowd to fade in from absolute silence. You'd like to start the crowd kind of low, but you wouldn't like to start the crowd at full scale, which would be full volume. Well, something you might consider doing then is using this dip/rise feature. You might take, say, the first 20 seconds of the recording, start the level at negative 20 dB, and gradually ramp it up to 0 dB. And that's what the dip/rise command helps you do. For this particular example, you would just select the first, 20 seconds of the file?
Mm-hmm.
Select the first 20 seconds in the usual way, and hit D for dip/rise. And then you're presented with four edit fields, two percentage and two level fields. So you set the first percentage to 0%, and the first level to negative 20, second percentage to 100%, and the second level to 0, which would be 0 dB or full scale. And then when you press enter, the dip rise would gradually bring that level in from negative 20 to 0 over time. You also have a choice of fade curves, which is a little complex for this discussion, but it basically controls how you want that ramp to occur, the shape of the curve that actually gets used. And we'll talk about that a little bit more when we talk about the fade commands. Dip/rise can also be used to bring down a loud outburst in a file. It's basically kind of like giving you the option to do your dynamic compression yourself. If there's just a couple of peaks in your file and you'd rather shape them yourself, you can use dip/rise to help with that. Say we have a car door slam, and the car door slam lasts about 0.5 seconds, essentially. The reverberation of it and such. You could select just a bit before that car door slam and end the selection a bit after, and then use dip rise to jump down at just before the slam and right back up after the slam. And in those cases, what you might do is use a level of, let's see, negative 10 dB and percentages of 50%. So essentially we would immediately start to drop as the slam approaches to negative 10 dB and set the first percentage for 50%. After that 50% passes, we gradually move up from negative 10 dB back to 0 dB. So that's how dip rise. And of course, you might have a situation that you need to rise something, like if somebody whispered something and you wanted to just sort of ramp up that part of the recording, then you could just do it the opposite than from a dip. But it's basically an accessible graphic fade, and we talked a little bit about accessible graphic fades in the early days of Blindpool Tech. This is a possible answer to that need. Let's talk about the fade commands. Those are new. We used to have just a real simple, the most basic of all fades, the linear fade. And the linear fade, basically, while it's easy to program and understand, it doesn't sound so great in a lot of situations. In the case of a linear fade out, it sounds loud for most of the fade and then abruptly gets soft toward the end. Well, now we have the ability to choose from four different fade types rather than the linear fade. We have, along with linear, a linear squared, a sine curve, and an exponential fade. And they all sound different. You really have to play with them to see which one you prefer. It also depends on the length of your selection. Like if you have 30 seconds to do a fade, then one curve is going to sound a whole lot better, perhaps, than if you just had 1 second to do a fade. But what we've done now is we have a fade tab on the settings dialog. And you go into that page, and there's different things you can configure the types of fades you want to use. For example, for the crossfade delete, you might want to use a linear fade. But for the regular fade in-out commands on the process menu, you might prefer a linear squared fade. And you configure all these things on the fade page of the settings dialog. And they just stick, and then you just change them as you need to. The only place where you get asked about a fade preference every time you use the command happens to be dip/rise, because that's kind of a more complex command. And it does, of course, remember the settings you used last time, so you don't have to mess with that if you just want to leave it alone. Let's see. We have the ability now to find the previous and next highest peak. When we find the next highest peak, by the way, it doesn't mean we're finding the peak that's just below the highest peak. We actually are finding the next occurrence of the highest peak in the file. It's a little confusing. Yeah. This basically looks through your file and just puts the caret right on the location of the highest peak found. So to search the whole file, you would go to the beginning, or you can search from the current position, either direction. And that's done with the less than and greater than keys. And the reason I tell you the keys here is because those keys used to do pre and post roll. But pre and post roll have been reassigned to comma and period. So keep that in mind as well. We have the ability to swap channels now. So if you either accidentally or intentionally record a file with the channels reversed, maybe you're having a bad day and you plug your mixer into your sound card with the wrong channels reversed, or maybe you put your binaural mics in the wrong ear.
Right.
Or maybe you want to play a file on the book port and you prefer the stereo image to be correct. Well, the swap channel command might be for you. It's probably not something you use often, but it's there if you need it. We have the trim edges command on the edit menu. And this is another one of those commands. It's like a tool. You won't use it very often, but it's there if you need it. it attempts to take silence off of the edges of a document. And you can specify the threshold of silence, and you can also specify an optional fade to be performed on the edge after the trimming has been done so that it doesn't just sort of pop in and out. You might use this command, for example, if you rip something off of a CD. A lot of times music CDs have a long lead-in and a longer tail that's either all silence or just basically digital dust, a lot of quantization noise and such that's just real low-level noise. And the trim edges command could be used in that situation to help just get that stuff out of there, and so you have just a song from start to finish and no extra stuff. We already hit generate click track. We have the previous window command, which kind of like previous channel on your remote control on your TV. It's the tab key, and it just flips between the last two documents you accessed while you're in Studio Recorder. Kind of handy if you're doing a multi-track mix and you want to work with the last two tracks that you're dealing with. In other words, you can arm a window, create a new window, record in that window, and then flip back to your arm window if you need to either close it or rearm it or whatever. We now finally report progress. On the status bar, there's a little area just to the right of the name of the function that's in progress, and it'll tell you the percentage that's complete of these long processes, like, for example, change volume, save, normalize. And it sort of gives you an opportunity to decide if you're going to wait or go get a cup of coffee, basically. That's all there is to say about that, I guess. It's just a real nice little touch. And you can always cancel a process with escape. Wouldn't normally recommend it. I mean, you can cancel anything you need to. If you cancel a save, however, you're going to have nothing. So you'd want to do that save again at some point and let it complete.
I'm actually tossed around the idea of having a cancel confirmation, too, on some of these things.
Oh, yeah?
I've accidentally canceled the MP3 processing so many times. That was back before the background.
You can't anymore.
I'm glad to hear that.
You have to be pretty sure you want to do it.
Yeah.
We have a new option on the advanced page of the settings dialog called use same folder for file functions. Let me translate that to English speaking people out there. Basically, it's amazing how you have to try to express a whole bunch of thoughts in one little checkbox.
Yeah, it makes for a long button, doesn't it?
It does. We have essentially right now in Studio Recorder there's five file based functions: open, save as, insert file, export to MP3, and save selection. And earlier versions of Studio Recorder were quite happy to use different folders for each of those functions as the default. So, and this is kind of stemmed from the way I like to work. For example, you might have source files in one folder, and you might be working on a project and saving the results of any processing or modifications into a different folder. And that makes it really convenient to keep your project's files separate and clean, and you don't have to worry about writing over files with the same name and such. But apparently this has caused a lot of undue stress. People expect their open and save to go to the same place. And so we listened and we added this feature. It's off by default, but if you turn it on, it will just essentially remember one folder path. So your open and save and insert file and such all work with the same folder at that point. And you can go back anytime you want by unchecking that box. We have the enable milestones checkbox.
One of my favorite features
on that same page, yeah. And what this does is essentially leaves named marks in special places of the file where you actually took action. For example, when you tap record, it'll leave a mark and it'll name that mark record over. And then you can navigate to those marks. If you've hit record five times in your file, then you can get to all those points of interest. And it's real handy. Like, for example, if you hit record and then you do stop at start, which is the enter key, that's essentially the same thing as popping back to that that milestone. But that only works once. That only works when you first come out of record. With the milestones, you have an opportunity to revisit that place as much as you need to.
And you just go to the show marks dialog.
Yeah, you can either go to show marks or you can do
your
previous
and
next mark command, and it'll put the name of the mark that you're on in the status line for you. And you can tell that it's a milestone. Milestones work for record, record insert, insert file, and paste.
Yeah, so let me just show you this. This is kind of easy.
Menu closed. Menu closed.
I'll insert a file.
Look at my BCT355.wav. Alan Show. MP3 2 of 309. Alan Show. MP3 is album. Your track genre covered.
In this click track document.
Okay.
So now I go to, I inserted this file. I go to the marks dialog with H.
Name. Insert file begin 000005 generic 1 of 2.
And the second mark I have.
Insert file end 00617 generic 2
of
2.
File end.
Yeah, so you have insert file start and insert file end in that case.
And if you want to go to the end of where you just inserted, now I can press my pre-post roll.
Have a very good Valentine's Day, folks.
And I happen to be at the end while I inserted that. So.
Yeah.
Very cool feature.
Yeah, it's nice
way to jump around through your...
And those are off by default, so it acts the old way. If you need milestones, just turn that on, and it'll stay there for life. And those milestones get saved in your file, so you kind of have a record of what you've done.
And if you open it up with another file, another audio editor, they're still preserved, correct?
It's also that audio editor respects riff wave marks. Some do, some don't. It preserves them unless you save. If you save, it's questionable. But editors like SoundForge, for example, won't hurt them. But I've seen other editors that use their own marking scheme that would probably just throw them away.
Okay.
Let's see. We no longer require a selection for fade and mute. This is kind of a not so interesting mundane feature, but if you use fade and mute a lot, I guess you don't use mute a whole lot because once you've used it, the whole track is muted, but it no longer requires a selection. So you can be working on a short sound effect and use your fade commands without having to do select all first. It's just kind of a little convenience feature. That mute command reminds me, when you're doing a synchronized mix, it can be handy to use the mute command to silence parts of the track that don't apply. So say we have a track that's 3 minutes long, but you don't. Your first vocal line is like at the 1.5 minute mark on this particular track. Well, if you want to be sure you get all the background noise out of there, like people banging glasses in the next room, or you breathe in, or clearing your throat, or whatever, mute command is real handy for that. It'll let you take that stuff out of there without changing the length of the track, so you'll still get your synchronization. So keep that in mind. I know that was kind of a bad place to bring that up, but just crossed my mind. And that's how this if we do this SR podcast demo.
You mean when we do it?
Yeah, that's how it's going to be. I'm just going to say whatever happens to be floating through my mind at that instant. That's about the only way I think I can get through this.
Well, and you know, speaking of floating through your mind at the instant, a minute ago we were talking about the marks dialog, and I do want to show you this fade command because this is kind of an easy way to show you how this works. If we go to the marks dialog again,
insert file end 00617 generic. Insert file begin 00005 generic.
Insert file start. Let me shut my window and try to control that airplane there. And I'll go ahead and go to that place in the file and play my pre-post roll.
Hi everybody, on the
so you've got the clicking and then Mary coming on. So I can hit an F here because I'm at the place where the file was first inserted.
Time of crossfade mix MST 1000.
It says time of crossfade in milliseconds. So if you just want a 1 second crossfade, you just put 1000 there. But we're going to do 5 for illustrative purposes.
Fade out data left of cursor, L checked.
Now you have two checkboxes too. You can fade out the data left of the cursor, which we will do.
fade in data right of cursor R. Checked.
Or you can fade in the data, or you can do both, right of the cursor. We won't fade in the data right of the cursor, just for illustrative purposes.
Unchecked.
And we'll go ahead and hit enter. And now when we play the pre-post roll.
Hi, everybody, on the BCT list. This is Mary. Actually, this is on the BCT podcast. Sorry about
that. Is that cool or what? So simple. That simple.
Yep. Very handy feature. Let's see. We now support additional remote controls. And what we mean by remote controls here is not usually not the kind that you point at your TV set. Rather, these are wired remote controls in most cases. And they commonly have your typical five transport keys at a minimum. Good old rewind, forward, stop, play, and record. But they often have other features as well, like maybe a jog shuttle wheel, maybe the ability to support function keys and such. And we added support for more. We used to just support the ARIA 11, which is the PlexTalk ARIA 11, but they discontinued that at the end of 2004. And
they didn't even consult with us before they did that.
Can't
imagine the nerve.
So we went out and found two controllers we like, and one we just happened to support because we had it available. The two we liked fairly well are the J.L. Cooper RS-232 model and the Frontier Designs Transport with a Z. And the Transport happens to be a wireless remote. So you can, I think it's like 30-foot range. So you can be 30 feet away from studio recorder in a booth and control a lot of the common functions that you might need to control, all the transport functions plus scrubbing plus marks. And
enough of the interface to make and edit a recording.
Yeah, sure is. And it also has a two-line LCD display, so you can see the time and the function. And, you know, you use these kind of remotes in a situation where you have perhaps a booth and you don't want a whole keyboard in there with you or you don't want the computer noise. So it's a real handy little feature, and so we support four of those. And if you have a remote control and you want to know what its keys do, we have on the help menu a remote control key describer. And basically it's like a key learn. You go in there and press all the different keys and turn the wheels on your remote and see what they do. And it tells you the name of the function as well as what it actually does. Like it might say, F1, place tone.
Or you might turn the wheel on the left and it'll say, rewind or scrub left.
Yeah, it's real handy. that's the wrap on remotes. I know a lot of people don't use them, but the people that do will sure find this a nice feature.
Yeah, it's more of something for a professional recording studio would be more likely to use it than you would in your house.
Yeah. We have changed the way start and end selection work, and I'm not going to get into too much detail because it was really confusing the way they used to work.
It was cool, but it was confusing if you didn't know what it was doing.
Yeah, and it turned out to be fairly useless. So now, if you try to set the start of the selection beyond the end of an existing selection, it'll beep and then it'll create a new selection with the start where you are and the end at the end of the document, just as if you didn't have a selection. This was coming up when people forgot to use the clear selection command. The way we had it written before, you had to almost burn into your brain to always hit C before you change the selection. Well, now, that's fine if you want to do that, but if you forget, this will tap you on the shoulder and try to do the best thing for you. And just kind of a helpful little feature there. let's see. We now support a clip threshold on the audible clip indicator sound. So if you're unfortunate enough to be stuck with one of these cheap sound cards that doesn't reach full scale, some of them may get to like negative 1 dB or negative 2 or so, you can set the clip peak threshold notification lower so that you can be notified even with your sound card. You
might have
negative 2 or so, or negative 1.
Unfortunately, the sad fact is there are some cards out there that do clip at less than full scale.
Right.
And this allows you to tailor the notification to your card.
It's real handy. Some of you might be familiar with our .mrk files, and those are marks that were in a file that was exported to MP3. And since there's no standard way to have marks in an MP3 file, we always saved what we called an external mark file, a .mrk file, along with the MP3 file, so that when you loaded it back into Stereo Recorder, you get your marks and your mark labels back. Well, it's real handy, unless for some reason those drive you crazy. And if it turns out you'd rather you spend most of your time deleting your mark files, then perhaps this command's for you. This is the ability to stop exporting those marks. You just uncheck that box. And
that's under Advanced, you say?
Yeah, down toward the bottom. Save External Marks is the name of the checkbox. It's checked by default, so you get your old behavior. Let's see. We have now a change to the way marks get handled when you record over material. We used to just leave the marks there, and
we went through a lot of trouble to do that too, oddly enough.
Yeah, it was one of those things where if you're replacing material with the same stuff, just read again, the marks usually made sense. But if you replace stuff with entirely different material, the marks would make no sense. So we now replace the marks when you record over them. Or actually, we just delete them, essentially, just like the record over feature deletes the data. And we think that's a better choice. The reasons we did it the other way were historical and studio-related here at APH. But we had a talk with them, and we decided that we better do it this way now.
And we had a big stick when we had that talk, too.
No. Right. let's see. That's essentially it. The rest of the stuff are minor changes, minor fixes, really. That's SR 3.0. We invite everybody to check it out. It's the full version is available as a beta till early May. So if you want to download the beta version, it's essentially the 3.0 with a different version number. And it runs until May, early May. And you can check out all the features and see how you like them.
Yep, we think you will be totally impressed. I know I am.
I would like to talk about an item I bought a few months ago called the Voice It All. It's a 3-in-1 combo unit that allows you to identify currency, identify colors, and record digital voice messages all in one unit. I purchased this unit a couple months ago from MaxiAids online for $250. This is the U.S. version. There is also a European version that does euros instead of U.S. dollars that costs a little bit more. Okay, I'm going to describe the Voice It All unit for you. I'm looking at it from the front. It is about 1 inch thick. It is approximately 4.75 inches in length and approximately 3.1 inches wide. There are buttons on the top of the unit. There are a couple slide or volume controls on the left side of the unit. On the right side of the unit, there is a switch to turn on and off the unit, and also a button for the color identifier. I'll describe these in a minute. On the front of the device, there is a slot that you slide your currency in. Below that on the bottom, there is a round place that is for the color identifier that you place up against whatever item you want to determine its color. There's also a slide on the front that it's for the guard for the color identifier. Okay, on the top of the unit, going from the left, there's a long button that goes up and down. That's your button that you press when you have slid a bill into the slot. It will tell you what the bill is. Either a 1, a 5, a 10, a 20, a 50, or a $100 bill. Along the top, also, there are two buttons that are for index back and forth. That's for the digital voice recorder. And also on the top, along the front of the top, there are three buttons. From the left, there is a play button, a record button, and a stop button. On the left side of the unit, as I said, there's two controls that you just rotate. The top one is a tone control, and the bottom one is your volume control. On the right-hand side of the unit, there's your power switch that you slide up and down. It's off and on. And there's a button that you can press when you're identifying colors. And on the back of the unit, there's a speaker and your section for your batteries that you can open up. The unit takes three AAA batteries. Okay, the first thing I'd like to talk about on the unit is the currency scanner. Currency scanner on this is real easy to use. You place the unit towards you. And on the front, there is a slot that you slide the bill down into. Once you do this, well, with the unit turned on, I'll turn the unit on for you so you can hear it. Okay, I've got the unit turned on. I'm going to slide a bill down into the slot that's on the front of the unit. It's really easy to do. You only have to place it in just a couple inches. There's a guide to help you with it. And then you press the button on the top of the unit. It's on the top left. It's a long button. It goes up and down the top of the unit. You press that.
$1.
And it will tell you what the bill is that you've slid in to the slot. This works real good. Actually, it's the best part of the unit. I've had very good success with identifying bills. I'd give it a 9 out of 10 as far as that. It's been very accurate. If you slide a bill into it, it can't identify it. It will say,
"Don't know."
Just like that, it'll say, "Don't know." Just take the bill out, slide it back in. If it still can't identify it, take the bill out. You can flip it over, or you can put the other side in. It doesn't really care which way the currency is slid into it. And it will, you know, it'll identify it. You know, if you've got a badly worn bill, it might take a couple of attempts. But generally, it will always identify it. I've had very little problems with that. The only time I've had it identify a bill wrong was when I put a $10 bill in it once and it told me it was $100, and I was pretty sure that that wasn't the case, so I just told it to identify it again. You know, I put the bill back in, identified it again, and it told me correctly what, you know, what the bill was. So that part of it works real good. Like I said, I'd give it a 9 out of 10. It's probably the whole unit is probably worth the $250. Just for the currency scanner. So I know I've seen other currency scanners, and a lot of them are a lot more money than $250. So that part alone is probably worth it. Okay, the next thing I'd like to talk about is the color identifier. The unit has a color identifier built into it. When you want to use it, you put the unit towards whatever you're going to scan. turn it on. You slide the slide next to it to, well, I guess to the right. It's kind of hard to say depending on which way you're going to use it. You put it up to the object. Right now I'm putting it up to my shirt. And you press the button on the right side. It's a little diagonal button below the power button. You can't miss it. Place the scanner against the object and press the button, and it will tell you what color it is.
Blue.
And it's telling me my shirt is blue. Leads me into the next thing about this that, you know, it doesn't quite work as good. The color scanning on this, I would give it a 5 out of 10. It's good, but it's not great. The shirt I happen to be wearing actually is green, but the scanner typically tries to say it's blue. It may have just a slight tinge of blue in it. It's very good at getting the primary colors, you know, red, green, blue, brown, black, white, purple, things like that, yellow, orange. I think according to the tape that comes with it, it only identifies 12 or 15 shades, so that's why it's not quite as accurate as some of the other color identifiers that are on the market that scan a lot more colors, a lot more accurately than this does. But overall, it does a good job. It, you know, it will tell you most colors reasonably accurate. It's good enough generally to get by. You know, if colors are critical to you, then you may want to have a better color identifier than this one. But all in all, it works pretty good. I like I said, I give it probably a 5 out of 10. Okay, the last thing I'd like to talk about on the unit is the digital voice recorder. And unfortunately, this is probably its poorest quality. It's adequate, but it's not great. I'm not sure if I can justify this on a microphone, but I'll try. The unit is capable of recording up to over 2 hours of voice memos. So as you could probably tell, the unit doesn't have much memory in it, and it records it at a very, I consider it a very low quality, but it's adequate. To record a message, you turn the unit on. I place the speaker on the back towards me, and the button will be on the top towards the right next to the money scan button. You press, it's the middle button, you press it in, the unit will beep, then you say your message, and then you press your stop button, which is on the top. It'll be the button towards the right. I'll record a message here and I'll let you hear it. Hello, this is a test of the Voice It All recorder. This is only a test. Okay, I think I did that right. Now I'll try to play it back to you.
Rick Harmon.
Nope, that's not the right one. Let me hit my index button. And try it again. Okay, as usual, I'm not doing something quite right. Let me try this again. Hello, this is a test of the Voice It All recorder. This is only a test. Okay, let me see if I did it right this time. I have a little bit of trouble with this. I sometimes get my buttons mixed up.
Rick Harmon.
Nope. Still not it. Boy, I don't know what it's doing.
Rick.
Oh, boy. It's giving me a heck of a time today. Let me try this one more time. Hello, this is a test of the Voice It All recorder. This is only a test. Oh boy, this thing's really being a pain today. I'm sorry.
Rick? Hello, this is a test of the Voice It All recorder. This is only a test.
Okay, I think I got it right that time. As you can tell, the voice recordings are not that great, and it takes a little bit of skill to hit the right buttons. I'm not real used to doing the voice recordings on it because I don't do very many because it's not very good. But overall, I think it's a good unit. Yeah, if you don't have a lot of money to spend, it's $249.95 at MaxiAids online, which compared to some of the other units isn't bad. You know, I've seen color identifiers for $600 and $700. I've seen money scanners for $600 and $700. You know, good voice message memo recorder, you know, $50, $100, you know, $50 to $100. And if you'd like some more info about it, you can get onto the MaxiAids site, www.maxiaids.com. It's the Voice It All USA.
This brings this week's edition of ACB Radio's Main Menu to a close. If you have any comments for the Main Menu production team, please do get a hold of us. We can be reached by emailing mainmenu@acbradio.org. That's mainmenu@acbradio.org. We'll see all of you next week on the next edition of ACB Radio's Main Menu.